Chapter 2. Center Pleasure. When I first started having long-ish term sexual relationships during my college years, I believed an old-fashioned narrative, which I think a lot of us are taught, about how desire works. We are told it's all about passion and spark early in a relationship, and that lasts a couple of years, maybe. Then we have kids, or buy a fixer-upper house, or generally get busy with work and life, and the spark fizzles out, especially after 50, when apparently every hormone we ever had floats away on a sea of aging, and we are left, sexless and neutered, to hold hands at sunset. Our options, we are told, are either to accept the fizzling of our desire for sex, or to fight against it, to invest our time, attention, and even our money in keeping the spark alive. Well, it turns out every part of that narrative is not merely wrong, but wrong-headed. A lot of books about sex in long-term relationships are about keeping the spark alive, and they too are wrong-headed. They're so 20th century with their rigid gender scripts and cringingly oversimplified ideas about sex and evolution. I call this mess of wrongheadedness the desire imperative. The desire imperative says, at the start of a sexual and/or romantic relationship, we should feel a spark of spontaneous, giddy craving for sexual intimacy with our potential partner that might even feel obsessive. The sparky desire we're supposed to feel at the beginning of a relationship is the correct, best, healthy, normal kind of desire. And if we don't have it, then we don't have anything worth having. If we have to put any preparation or planning into our sex lives, then we don't want it enough. If our partner doesn't just spontaneously want us out of the blue without effort or preparation on a regular basis, they don't want us enough. The desire imperative puts desire at the center of our definition of sexual well-being. It says there is only one right way to experience desire, and without that, nothing else matters. And so people worry about sexual desire. If desire changes or it seems to be missing, people worry that there's something very wrong. It's the most common reason couples seek sex therapy. Here's the irony of the desire imperative. Does all that worry about spark activate the accelerator and make it easier to want and like sex? On the contrary, worry mainly hits the brakes and puts sex further out of reach. But there's an alternative. Center pleasure. Desire is not what matters. Not passion. Not keeping the spark alive. Pleasure is what matters. Center pleasure. Because great sex over the long term is not about how much you want sex. It's about how much you like the sex you're having. I'll be repeating this a lot because we have all spent so many years soaking in the desire imperative that even people who know better, including me, can find themselves slipping back into worry about desire. Here's a helpful analogy about pleasure versus desire, which I learned from sex therapist Christine Hyde. Imagine your best friend invites you to a party. You say yes because it's your best friend, and it's a party. Then as the date approaches, you start thinking, oh, I have to arrange childcare. There's going to be so much traffic. Am I really going to want to put on my party clothes at the end of a long week? But you said you would go, so you arrange the childcare, you deal with the traffic, and you put on your party clothes. Maybe you even bop to some fun music as you trim your ear and nose hair, then don the glitter and platform heels. You show up to the party. And what happens then? Usually, you have fun at the party. If everyone's having fun at the party, you are doing it right. The party metaphor is a gentle, simple way to explain that sexual satisfaction is not about spark. It's about connecting in a way that feels worthwhile to you and your partner. An even easier way to explain it? Pleasure is the measure. Pleasure is the measure of sexual well-being. Like I said in the introduction, great sex over the long term isn't about how often you do it or where you do it or with whom or in what positions or how many orgasms you have or even how enthusiastically you anticipate sex, but how much you like the sex you are having. In this chapter, let's get clear about what we mean by pleasure and what we mean by desire. After that, I'll describe why pleasure belongs at the center of our definition of sexual well-being, allowing desire to be on the periphery. By the end of this chapter, I hope you'll begin to notice when you start worrying about desire, yours or your partner's, and think instead, ah, there's the desire imperative again. That's my cue to center pleasure. Spontaneous desire versus responsive desire. A simple place to start changing how we think about desire and pleasure is understanding what sex researchers and therapists say about desire. They call the spark of the desire imperative spontaneous desire, and it is one of the normal ways to experience sexual desire. But it is not associated with great sex in a long-term relationship. They also describe responsive desire, which is not a spark feeling, but rather an openness to exploring pleasure and seeing where it goes. It often shows up as scheduled sex, where you plan ahead, prepare, groom, get a babysitter, and then you show up. You put your body in the bed. You let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body wakes up. It says, "Oh, right! I really like this! I really like this person!" Where spontaneous desire emerges in anticipation of pleasure, responsive desire emerges in response to pleasure. Both are normal, and neither is better than the other. But it's responsive desire that is associated with great sex over the long term. Responsive desire. Not passion, not spark, but pleasure. Trust. And mutuality. That's the fundamental empirical reason to center pleasure over spark. So, what's pleasure? Pleasure is sensation in context. Pleasure is the measure of sexual well-being. That is, whether or not you like the sex you are having. Pleasure is the measure. So what even is pleasure? Well, does the sensation feel good? How good? Does it feel bad? How bad? That's the whole thing. Pleasure is the simplest thing in the world in the sense of declaring whether a sensation feels good or not. Next time you're eating your very favorite food, notice what that pleasure is like, the food's appearance, its texture, aroma, and flavor. Notice what pleasure does to your body. Pleasure is simple. But that doesn't mean it's always easy. We've been lied to about the nature of pleasure, just as we've been lied to about the nature of desire. We've been told that sexual pleasure is supposed to be easy and obvious. And if it's not easy and obvious, then there's something wrong. For some people, experiencing pleasure is like finding Waldo. So frustrating, you start to wonder why you're even looking. We've been told that pleasure comes from being touched in the right place, in the right way, by the right person. And if that touch, in that place, by that person, feels good some of the time, but not other times, that's a problem. These lies show up in movies and romance novels and porn, where the main characters may be running away from the villain or even just exhausted and overwhelmed by life. But partner A touches the magic spot on partner B's body, and it doesn't matter what else is going on. Partner B's knees melt and their genitals tingle. If that's how pleasure works for you, cool. But for the rest of us, pleasure isn't about the right place on your body, touched in the right way. It's the right place, the right way, by the right person, at the right time, in the right external circumstances, and in the right internal state. In short, it's sensation in the right context. A simple example of this is tickling. Tickling is not everyone's favorite, though it is some people's favorite. But you can imagine a scenario where partners are already turned on in a trusting, playful, erotic situation, and partner A tickles partner B, and it feels good. And if those same partners are in the middle of an argument about, say, money, and partner A tries to tickle partner B, will that feel good? Or would partner B feel more like punching somebody in the nose than snuggling? Because pleasure is sensation in the right context, that means any sensation may feel good, great, spectacular, just okay, or terrible, depending on the context in which you experience it. Conscious pleasure is different from conscious pain. Because pain is a danger signal, a warning that we may not be safe, it gets priority in our brains. Pleasure can be rewarding, but as far as our basic survival is concerned, pain takes precedence. Pain is a rude customer pulling insistently at your attention. Hey, listen to me, there's a problem, hey. Pain is stubborn, too, often persisting long after the painful event has ended or the injury has healed. You solve the rude customer's complaint, and it's not enough. Any reminder of the bad experience, and pain may start complaining all over again. Conscious pleasure is more fragile. Pleasure is a shy animal. We can observe it from a safe distance, but if we approach too fast, it will run. If we try to capture it, it will panic. You have to build trust with your pleasure before it will allow you to observe it closely. Pain happens when our brains interpret a signal from our bodies as a sign of danger. And our brains are more likely to interpret something as a sign of danger when there are already lots of other signals about danger in our brains. When you're stressed, your brain is primed to interpret almost anything as a threat. When you're already in pain, other sensations are more likely to be experienced as additional pain. When you feel unsafe, sick, untrusting, threatened, or in any way at risk for harm, your brain is only too ready to interpret a sensation as uncomfortable, irritating, or even painful. Pleasure happens when we feel safe enough, trusting enough, healthy enough, welcome enough, at low enough risk. Everyone's threshold for enough is different, and it changes from situation to situation. But when we create that safe enough context, our brains have the capacity to interpret any sensation as pleasurable. Context means both your internal state and your external circumstances. Later in this chapter and throughout the rest of this book, we'll talk about how to create a context that grants your brain easy access to sexual pleasure. Right now, all you need to do is recognize that it is normal for a sensation to feel good today and not so good tomorrow simply because the context changed. Pleasure is not desire, though desire can be pleasurable. Pleasure and desire are different systems in the brain. At the level of the emotional mammalian brain, desire is known as wanting or incentive salience, and pleasure is discussed as liking or hedonic impact. Dear fellow nerds, yes, indeed, there's a huge difference between the subjective experience of pleasure and the neurological process of hedonic impact, as there is a difference between the subjective experience of desire and the neurological process of incentive salience. If you know what the difference is, Rest assured that I know too, but this distinction between pleasure and desire is already really difficult for people to wrap their heads around without going into a discussion of interactions across levels of analysis. And I've found that teaching people about levels of analysis doesn't help people have better sex lives, which is the purpose of this book. The science is functioning here as a metaphor. This is one of many, many shortcuts I take in the name of helping people have better sex lives. Feel free to be frustrated by it if you like. And then remind yourself that you started this book to make your sex life better. And this metaphor helps with that. And hey, look up Kent Berridge if you want the science itself. Wanting in the brain is a vast network of dopamine-related circuitry that mediates how motivated we are to pursue a goal. Liking, by contrast, is a set of smaller hedonic hotspots where opioids and endocannabinoids mediate how good a sensation feels. Pleasure is, oh, that's nice, and yay! Desire is, ooh, what's that, and how do I get more? Pleasure is stillness, savoring what's happening in the moment. Desire is forward movement, exploring to create something that doesn't currently exist. Pleasure is a perception of a sensation. Desire is motivation toward a goal. In a sense, pleasure is satisfaction, and desire is dissatisfaction, because pleasure is enjoying an experience, while desire is motivation to pursue something different. Here, I'll put it in a list. Pleasure is liking, opioids and endocannabinoids. Ah, that's nice. Yum! Yay! That feels so good. Enjoying, perception, hedonic impact, satisfaction. Desire is wanting. Dopamine. Ooh, what's that? Where is it? How do I get it? I want more. Eagerness. Motivation. Incentive salience. Dissatisfaction. And here is the first illustration to describe. If you want to imagine the neuroanatomy of wanting and liking, imagine a large network of dopamine-related circuitry managing the wanting system. And within that network, there are tiny overlapping spots where liking happens. They're different, though overlapping, neural systems with different, though overlapping, experiences linked to them. For sure they are related to each other, but you can want more of something without liking it, and you can like something without wanting more of it. Consider the wanting involved in continuous, joyless scrolling on social media. You're searching for something you can't name, maybe for the reward of at last finding something that makes you feel good or that even confirms your worst fears. You want something, but you're not enjoying it. You're just following the urge to keep looking. Desire without pleasure. Boredom, at its most uncomfortable, is wanting without liking. Your brain is searching for something to focus on, something to do with itself. All those neurons and nothing to occupy them. It's not like daydreaming or mind-wandering, where you simply allow your brain to travel imaginary paths and feel satisfyingly occupied. Conversely, consider the liking involved in being handed a gift out of the blue. The moment of receiving the gift, even before you open it, is pleasure in the absence of desire. It is the pleasure of learning that someone was thinking of you when you weren't there. The delight of watching your favorite people enjoying themselves together is liking without wanting. Suppose you put in the effort to throw a party, and now here they are, all your favorite people laughing together and playing. Pleasure. Satisfaction. Because something you planned is bringing pleasure to people you love. And it doesn't even matter that the pleasure was planned rather than spontaneous. So far, so simple. Where it can get muddy is in how desire feels. Pleasure, by definition, feels good. Desire, per se, is more or less neutral. It's the context that makes it feel good or bad. I think people confuse desire for pleasure because desire sometimes feels good. Once we recognize that desire can also feel bad, we begin to understand both how desire and pleasure are not the same thing and why pleasure is the one that really matters. How sexual desire feels. Anticipation, expectation, craving, longing. These are all ways of experiencing desire that can feel delightful and even ecstatic. But anticipation, expectation, craving, and longing can also feel frustrating, irritating, and annoying. Desire can be hope and optimism, but it can also be anxiety and fear. Whether desire feels good or not depends on the context. All pleasure depends on the context. If you have experienced desire, stop and recall a moment when it was pleasurable. Probably the object of your desire, whether it was a lover or a new gadget or a tasty snack, seemed within reach. Maybe you felt in control of whether or not you got what you wanted. Maybe your desire was grounded in a promise someone made that filled you with anticipation. The pleasurable version of spontaneous desire is, I think, why people get confused about the difference between pleasure and desire, and why we might be convinced that spontaneous is the good, right, normal kind of desire. After all, it was easy, or at least it happened out of nowhere, and it was fun. But spontaneous sexual desire can feel terrible, too. Suppose you can't figure out how to get closer to your object of desire, or the object of your desire is entirely out of reach, or worse, actively rejecting you, pushing you away. In that context, your ongoing desire can feel like a form of torture. If you've wanted to want sex, you've experienced a different uncomfortable desire. Many people who struggle to let go of the ideal of spontaneous desire know how awful it feels to want something you can't get, which is why it's so important that we remind ourselves that it's responsive desire, not spontaneous desire, that characterizes great sex over the long term. If you enjoy the sex you have, you're already doing it right, and you're allowed to stop trying to create spontaneous desire. If we only think about the pleasurable experiences of desire, we end up using the words pleasure and desire more or less interchangeably. But they're different. We know they're different because of the brain science. And if pleasure is always pleasurable, but desire is only sometimes pleasurable, doesn't it make sense to center pleasure and allow desire to emerge in contexts that maximize the chances that desire will feel good? Are you still worried about spontaneous desire? If I wanted to spark controversy, I'd say there's no such thing as a sexual desire problem. And all the news articles and think pieces and self-help books and medical research focused on a cure for low desire are irrelevant. The cure for low desire is pleasure. When we put pleasure at the center of our definition of sexual well-being, we eliminate any need to worry about desire. But I'm not here for controversy. I'm here to make your sex life better. So I'll just say, don't sweat desire. If you're worried about a partner's low desire, ask them about pleasure. If you're worried about your own low desire, talk to your partner about pleasure. You'll find lots of tools for these conversations throughout the book. Desire can be a fun bonus extra. It's as important as simultaneous orgasms, which is to say, a neat party trick, but not remotely necessary for a satisfying long-term sex life. And yet, in my unscientific survey of a few hundred strangers, some people reported that what they want when they want sex is spontaneity. Like, I hate talking about having sex before I have sex. Like, if it can't happen naturally, I kind of don't want it. Oof, that word. Naturally. If the idea of talking about sex or making a plan before you have it feels unnatural, hi, hello. Welcome. This section of the book is here to acknowledge the reality that talking about sex might deflate spontaneous desire, but also to ask you to consider the possibility that planning sex can be part of the pleasure. And talking about sex is not just natural, it's part of the erotic connection between you and a partner. Maybe every sexual experience you've had in response to spontaneous desire has been better than any sex you've ever had in response to a plan. But did you really not plan before any of that great spontaneous sex? When you're in a new or emerging relationship, do you not spend time daydreaming about a hot date, making plans for dinner or an adventure together, exchanging flirtatious texts, emails, phone calls, whispers? Hot and heavy, falling in love horniness is often accompanied by a lot of planning and preparation and, yes, even talking about sex in advance. Do you not spend time getting ready for it? Grooming? Dressing carefully? Making sure you smell good? Is that natural? The myth that the natural way to have sex is for it to be spontaneously born of mutual horniness without having to talk about it or make a plan? That's the desire imperative I described at the start of this chapter. The desire imperative insists that without spontaneous desire, we don't want sex enough. If we have to plan it, there's a problem. But consider what our lives are like, what our contexts are like. We schedule large portions of our days, often weeks or even months in advance. We fill our calendars with work and school and family and friends and entertainment. We fill our bodies with stress and a sense of obligation to others and to ourselves. We impose modern exigencies that don't even create adequate opportunity for natural sleep, much less unplanned yet mutually enthusiastic sex. I'd like people who adore spontaneity to consider the possibility that spontaneity matters less than pleasure. To that end, I want to acknowledge the real phenomenon of spontaneous desire potentially evaporating when you talk about sex. It's true. I've felt it, and I want to show you how little it matters. Back in my 20s, I had an on-again, off-again relationship with someone I'll call Cohen. It's not his real name. At a certain point, we agreed we would stop having sex because it was only making our lives more complicated and miserable. Then, inevitably, one night after a party, I went back to his place for coffee and a chat, and he made a move. Honestly, it was sexy. I felt all the excitement of, I want to, but I shouldn't. But we'd had good reasons for our decision to stop having sex. My, I shouldn't, wasn't just a playful, ooh, I'm a bad girl. It was, we're going to damage each other badly if we do this. It was, we're going to break each other's hearts. Again. So instead of kissing him back, I said, we decided not to do this. And Cohen said, but what if just this once? While he kissed my neck, I reiterated the reasons we had decided not to do this. For example, he was still in love with his ex. As he had said himself, over and over. When he had sex with someone, he habitually fell into the role of boyfriend, so I'd feel like he was acting like my boyfriend, and he'd feel like he was waiting for his ex to come back. So not only were we totally unable to meet each other's needs as romantic partners, we were destroying the friendship we had had before we started having sex. Cohen said, "What if we agree that I won't do that?" Valiantly resisting the pull of desire, I said, "Can you? Because I am too busy and too exhausted to go through that again." He actually thought about it, and he said, "Yes." And I believed him. Now, in a romance novel or a TV show, what would happen next is we'd both feel set free from the ambivalence that was holding us back, and we'd slam our bodies together like we'd each been released from a slingshot. In a way, I wish that were what had happened, because then I could say, see, talking about it makes it extra horny. But in real life, the opposite happened. My ambivalence had been hot air, keeping the balloon of my lust swollen and ready. When I resolved my ambivalence by talking about it, my horniness deflated. Cohen stood up to go lock his apartment door, and by the time he got back, seconds later, I felt neutral about having sex. What would you think in a moment like that? Would you worry that something had gone wrong? Would you decide the sex wasn't worth having if the pulsing horniness evaporated? Would you wish you hadn't protected you and your partner from unwanted consequences if it meant preserving the spontaneity? I'm sure the person who wrote, "If it can't happen naturally, I kinda don't want it," would have stopped everything there. No sex for them that night. But my story doesn't end with the deflating of my spontaneous desire. Cohen and I did have sex that night, and it was really fun. It was playful instead of desperate. Rather than just getting naked right there in the living room, as we would have had to in order to avoid confronting the real choice we were making, I asked him to drag me into his bedroom by one ankle. And the next day, he did not fall into his old habits. It worked out this way because I had already begun deconstructing the desire imperative in my own life. It's true that talking about it and resolving the "we want to but we shouldn't" ambivalence drained away my hot craving, but even then, I knew that's not a bad thing. So even though I can't say, "See? Talking about it makes it extra horny," I can say, "See, talking about it makes it more fun, and you don't have to worry about the consequences later." When you center pleasure instead of desire, you have access to pleasurable experiences that minimize the risk of unwanted consequences. Imagine if it hadn't been emotional consequences, but physical health or social consequences that I was considering. Suppose I had said, "This is very hot, but do you have a condom?" Or, "But I need to pause and get some lube." Or, "Isn't your other relationship monogamous?" Or even just, "Hey, can you check that the door is locked?" Any of these can deflate spontaneity. But imagine the unwanted consequences people experience if they follow the desire imperative. Sexually transmitted infections, unwanted pregnancy, damage to your reputation, hurting someone's feelings, having your own feelings hurt, these and more are all real and important potential consequences that deserve priority over protecting spontaneity. A lot of sex educators say that interrupting sex this way to talk about something like birth control or STI prevention and other emotional or physical safety issues doesn't impact desire. And I'm sure for some people it doesn't. But for other people, people like me, it may impact desire. But that's no big deal, because desire is not the point. Pleasure is the point. I don't expect you to believe me right away. I know you've probably been taught to worry about desire. It might even feel troubling or problematic to say that desire doesn't matter. Maybe you're thinking, what could you possibly mean, Emily, to not worry about not wanting it and just enjoy it instead? Are you telling me to enjoy sex I don't want? On the contrary, I'm saying, imagine a world where all of us only ever have sex we enjoy. And anything we don't enjoy, we just don't do. We don't do it, and get this, we don't worry about not doing it. When we put pleasure at the center of our definition of sexual well-being, sex we don't like is never even on the table. Mike and Kendra. I didn't know Mike and Kendra at the beginning of their struggles. I only met them at the end. It took them some time and several different approaches before they found all the tools they needed, but I guarantee you they found their happily ever after. The nature of their struggle? Mike wanted Kendra to want him spontaneously and passionately. She used to. Early in their relationship, she experienced spontaneous desire, often and easily. But for the last 4 years, she almost never felt spontaneous desire. That change began with her first quite difficult pregnancy and continued through the second easier pregnancy, breastfeeding, and weaning of their second child, now a one-year-old toddler. For 4 years, they had been having sex when he wanted it or when she felt so guilty that she initiated. This isn't even close to a worst-case scenario for a couple like this. But when I finally heard what they had been going through, I felt heartbroken for them. Mike wanted to feel wanted again. On one level, of course he did. It's one of the big four, the most common things people want when they want sex with a partner. Heck, who doesn't want to be wanted? And Kendra had wanted him, spontaneously and passionately, at the beginning of their relationship. But on another level, they liked the sex they had when they had it, and, as Kendra pointed out sometimes, if he didn't make such a big deal about spontaneous desire, they literally would not have a problem. They are not people who fight. Yelling is not their style. They prefer to sit down and have conversations and listen to each other's feelings and try to find common ground. They read Come As You Are, and Kendra really wanted to incorporate the idea of responsive desire into their approach to sex. But Mike was mostly interested in ways to create spontaneous desire for Kendra. They discussed this difference calmly and reasonably. Over and over. For years. Can you feel how focused all of that is on desire? On fixing Kendra so that she has the desire experience Mike wants her to have? At the start of their journey, Kendra tried a thought experiment. One night, when they were lying in bed together, having not had sex again, she said, "Can it be enough sometimes if we just enjoy it without having to be super horny for each other? Can it be enough that I really like sex with you even when I'm not turned on before we start?" But how can we really like the sex if we don't want it first? "Dude," Kendra said, "I do it all the time." "What? All the time? If I'm just in a good mood and know it'll make you happy if I initiate, I go ahead and flirt with you and kiss you and enjoy it, and we have sex and it feels great and I'm like, wow, I'm glad we did that. We should do that again sometime." Mike nodded and thought. Then he said, "That doesn't seem right, that we just have a nice time together. We should be hot for each other, like we can't wait, like it was before. Sure, a longer-term goal, but I want to think about what would happen if, for the time being, we just really enjoyed each other without needing to change anything. What if, in this season of our life, enjoying each other is enough?" Silence from Mike as he processed. Kendra added, Because spontaneous desire is not something I seem to have any control over, but pleasure is. And imagine if I was like, I only want to have sex with you when you don't have a spontaneous desire. Stop experiencing spontaneous desire so we can have truly great sex. Wouldn't that feel terrible? But that's just never a problem. How does my desire have anything to do with yours? This was the point when Kendra's emotional energy ran out. She said, well, maybe your constant spontaneous desire is creating a lot of pressure for me and actually makes it more difficult for me to experience it myself. But that's crazy. This is just how I am. And you used to be like this too. Something happened. Something went wrong. Kendra sighed and said, okay, well, maybe think about it. Let's just notice what a heroic effort she put into being extremely calm. This is the emotional labor that so many women put into their relationships, especially those with men. She could have said, no, you're crazy. It's crazy to think that just because I changed, there's something wrong. Everything in our lives changed, and I changed with it. Maybe there's something wrong with you, that you're not adapting at all. But obviously, it's just as not okay for her to call him crazy as it was for him to call her crazy. She could have said, how does your desire have anything to do with mine? Are you kidding? How does my desire have anything to do with yours, you stinking hypocrite? But she knew that kind of criticism and contempt would have raised his defenses, which wouldn't help him make progress. She didn't say these things because they're not people who fight. But also, Mike could have said, huh, I'm starting to notice that my investment in your spontaneous desire isn't really about what I want for you, it's about what I want for me. If I can focus instead on your pleasure for you, that would take away the pressure that might actually be making it more difficult for me to have what I want. He could have said, well, we've been trying it my way without success for a long time now. How about we try it your way and see what happens? I feel like the worst thing that can happen is we have some sex we enjoy, and the best thing that could happen is we have sex we enjoy so much that you start wanting it more often. But he didn't, because neither of them yet saw the towering external force that was obstructing their view of the solution to their struggles. It would take many more conversations before they made the shift to centering pleasure and co-creating a pleasure-positive context. Both of them had spent their entire adult lives believing that spark and passion are the defining characteristics of a great sex life. It takes time to shift to a fundamentally different way of understanding sexuality. Context is a third thing. The rest of this book is about co-creating with a long-term partner a context that makes pleasure easier. And yes, indeed, I'm going to be suggesting that you talk with your partner about context. I'm going to suggest so much talking that if I do my job right, you may spend more time talking with your partner about sex than you spend doing it. It's not always easy to talk about sex, and I'll offer tools to make it easier in part two of the book. But getting to know each other's context is an essential part of building a satisfying sexual connection that can last decades. It will take more talking early in the process as you explore and learn about your own, your partner's, and your shared contexts. Gradually, you'll come to know each other so well, much can go unspoken. I think people's difficulty talking about sex is related to how they feel about pleasure and desire. If you buy into the desire imperative, you may have become convinced that if you have to talk about it, there must be a problem. And that's just not true. Couples with great long-term sexual connections talk about sex. Or if you've been taught to feel shame around pleasure, then talking about what you want and like may feel inherently shameful, even with the person with whom you share those pleasures. Releasing yourself from the desire imperative and from pleasure shame are not changes that will happen today. They will happen little by little as you step outside your cultural learning into the sunlight of your shared pleasures. to make it a little easier, I suggest you try to replace the idea of sexual desire with the idea of sexual interest. To me, sexual interest is sexual curiosity. You're probably listening to this book because you are interested in sex, even if you don't currently desire it. You are curious. You want to learn more, dive deeper, discover ways to create positive change, or to cope with unwanted change. Hi, hello, is your partner also interested in sex? By which I mean, do they find sex interesting? Remember, the couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over multiple decades are not the ones who crave the sex. They're friends who decide that sex matters in their relationship. They're interested in sex, curious about it. It's important to them in all its expansive variety. I've started thinking of the shared project of creating a great context for sex as a third thing, something both partners are interested in and want to spend time on. I get this term from poet Donald Hall, who wrote of his 23-year marriage to poet Jane Kenyon in an essay titled The Third Thing. We did not spend our days gazing into each other's eyes. We did that gazing when we made love or when one of us was in trouble, but most of the time, our gazes met and entwined as they looked at a third thing. Third things are essential to marriages. Objects or practices or habits or arts or institutions or games or human beings that provide a site of joint rapture or contentment. A third thing is a shared interest, like your favorite TV show, or your love of sushi, or the sports team to which you're loyal, or the parties you throw together. What do you and your long-term partner do with the time you have chosen to spend together? What are your third things, your sites of joint rapture or contentment? It could be your kids, or the works of Frida Kahlo, or women's soccer, or the vegetable patch in your yard, or swing dancing, or LARPing, or your special needs cat. And it could be the co-creation of contexts that make it easier to experience pleasure. I believe your shared context is worthy of your shared attention, a third thing that holds your mutual interest. Paying ongoing attention to context allows you to assess and adjust your lives and your relationship. This is not sexual desire itself in the way we're used to thinking about desire. It's being interested in sex and in each other. It's being interested in pleasure. Maybe think about it this way. Spontaneous desire is like knowing there's cake in the fridge, a delicious, gorgeous cake, your desire for which has nothing to do with hunger and everything to do with the delight of that mouthful of glorious flavor. Maybe you wake up in the middle of the night and your first thought is, there's cake in the fridge. There's nothing wrong with spontaneous desire. Cake is delicious, though if you're gluten sensitive, your longing for cake is a torment, not a delight. Context changes everything. Responsive desire is like showing up to a party where there's delicious, delicious cake. Sure, it might start out feeling like you're just showing up because you said you would, but once you're there and you hear the beat of the music and you see the laughing faces of your favorite people, you join in with pleasure. Then there are the couples who center pleasure by co-creating a context that makes pleasure easy. In terms of the party metaphor, they don't just show up. They love to entertain. When they're at the grocery store, they consider what's necessary to keep their fridge stocked with everything they need to create a beautiful charcuterie board, bruschetta, fresh guacamole. As they get ready for the party, they take time to lay the mortadella in beautiful little heaps on a handmade board they bought with their partner at the farmer's market they explored on a vacation 15 years ago. They mound the goat cheese in a pretty depression glass sherbet bowl inherited from a beloved friend. They place a long sprig of rosemary across a basket of freshly baked rolls still steaming from the oven. Why take time to make a meal beautiful? Why think ahead as you write a grocery list for a get-together you don't even know for sure you'll have? Maybe some people put in that kind of effort simply to show off or impress people. But for people who prioritize sharing pleasure with loved ones, all that effort is part of the pleasure you anticipate sharing. You put in the extra forethought because that's how much you care about creating pleasure to share. In concrete terms, responsive desire might look like you show up to a scheduled date night, stressed and distracted, but glad to be there. You let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body wakes up and goes, "All right, I like this. I like this person. What a good idea this is." But when you center pleasure, you plan ahead, adjusting your schedule so that you have a minimum of stress on the day of the date, and considering what your partner might need in order to be in a great state of mind on that day. Centering pleasure is finishing the laundry and the dishes to minimize distractions and cleaning the bathtub so your partner can have a relaxing bath. Above all, centering pleasure looks like asking your partner what helps them to feel cared for, attended to, and wanted. It looks like sharing with your partner what helps you to feel cared for, attended to, and wanted. You're probably not aroused as you do those dishes. You probably don't feel horny as you scrub the ring of soap scum from the tub. You are not in the mood. But you don't have to be in the mood for your best friend's birthday party while you plan it. You don't have to feel like going to your kid's martial arts competition in order to order an ice cream cake for the day. You don't need a mood. You need to care. It needs to matter to you. We plan and prepare for so many things that matter in our lives. Why would we believe that sex should just happen without effort? And why, if sex matters to us and our relationships, would we not want to put whatever effort we can into making it a delight? Not all the sex in your relationship needs to be an event, of course. When I say center pleasure or co-create a context that makes it easier to access pleasure, sometimes that means planning an event, but sometimes it means out of the blue little erotic encounters that just happen because you've put time and effort into creating a context that makes it easy for them to happen. Assess the context. If pleasure is the shy animal I described before, appearing only in the right context and staying only when we approach gently and observe it calmly, what is the right context? The rest of this book is all about understanding what contexts make it easy for your brain to access pleasure, what context you're currently in, and how to create change in your context. Here, let's begin with a simple exercise. First, think of a specific experience when you had easy, abundant pleasure, and consider what aspects of the context made accessing pleasure easy. Don't fall into the desire imperative's trap of imagining an experience when you had a lot of spontaneous desire. Your easy pleasure may coincidentally have been accompanied by desire, but it's not the desire that matters. If you've never experienced easy, abundant pleasure, you can imagine a situation that you expect might make pleasure easy. Context is made of a combination of internal state and external circumstances. The next chapter, your emotional floor plan, is all about your internal state. So for now, let's consider external circumstances. This includes things like your relationship with your partner, the setting, and other life factors like stress about your job or worry about money, your family, and the state of the world. Relationship issues were the contextual factor that I fixed with Cohen, that moment many years ago when my desire faded but my pleasure expanded. In your experience of easy pleasure, how was your relationship with the partner with whom you shared that pleasure? External factors also include the setting where sex happens. Setting is what mattered for the couple who built their bed into the wall. Are you at home, in your shared bed with your certain special someone? Are you on vacation together? Are you in front of your screen at one end of a wireless internet connection while your partner is at the other end? Are you in the bathroom at your favorite nightclub? The setting that will make it easier for your brain to access pleasure will vary from person to person and relationship to relationship. And it's important to note that a fantasy context may be entirely different from a real-life context. If the fantasy of the bathroom at your favorite nightclub opens up your brain's access to pleasure, that doesn't mean that the reality of that bathroom will have the same effect. Even small adjustments to a real setting can make a difference. For example, when I was struggling, my spouse and I realized that we could remove one barrier to sex by making it easier to close the bedroom door. Most of the time, we kept the door propped open with a small linen chest so the dogs could come and go. But during sexy times, we opted to keep the dogs out of the room. Closing the door required moving the chest and then pulling up a large corner of rug to get it out of the path of the door. It was a minor hassle with a simple solution. We removed the rug and the little chest, propping the door with a small, easy-to-move wastebasket instead. Also, sex towels. Our sex sometimes involves some bodily fluids, and wiping is often part of our afterplay. It's not super sexy to have to get out of bed dripping with fluids and go into the bathroom to get a towel, especially on a cold New England night. Solution? We allocated a drawer, reachable from the bed, to fill with towels dedicated to sex. Some problems are just that easy to solve. Move a piece of furniture. Put some linens in a different drawer. These were small changes to our setting that made a noticeable difference. When you've got a sense of the context that made it easy for your brain to access pleasure, try thinking about your current context. How's your relationship? What's your setting? How are you feeling about the state of the world? And how do you feel about pleasure? Pleasure feels good, but how do you feel about feeling good? How do you feel about pleasure? This is a too often ignored factor that I want to emphasize early. How do you feel about pleasure itself, especially sexual pleasure? Just as we were lied to about pleasure, told that it was obvious and easy, we were lied to about how to feel about pleasure. Too many of us were taught to fear, resent, and otherwise disparage pleasure. The late, great sex educator Betty Dodson encountered this often as she coached many women to orgasm. Her rock and roll method taught women to ride the visceral wave of arousal and orgasm as pleasure rolled through them like a rising tide. She made a series of instructional videos showing women's evolving relationships with their own sexual pleasure. In one video, one of Betty's clients, Cynthia, aged 41, isn't sure if she was having orgasms or if she was having them, thought they were small, almost nothing orgasms. What I picture it being like, or I think it should be like, is just bigger, all over bigger, and more where you're just out of control and you're just very dramatic. Betty assures her, you're never out of control. You're in your body. The only thing you're out of is your mind. Early in her coached masturbation session, Cynthia tells Betty that the lowest setting of the vibrator is good, and she doesn't want lube. Eventually, though, Betty directly invites more intense vibration and lube. Immediately, Cynthia recognizes that's better. Hang on it. Oh, hang on it. Betty coaches her as Cynthia's moans crescendo. After Cynthia's second orgasm, she describes her revelation. I never let the vibrator stay on long enough. Instead of backing off when it feels so intense, I kept it there. And that's when it gets very, when you meet it, it feels like it really changes the whole thing. It felt like, oh, I have to take it away. It's too much. But it isn't too much. That's the most important thing to learn, Betty praises. When it gets really strong, move into it. Meet it, Betty tells her. Get in it. Throughout her session, Cynthia has, by my count, at least 3 orgasms. The barrier to her pleasure was her uncertainty in the face of pleasure that felt so good it seemed like too much. This is the story of our relationships with pleasure. We feel like it's too much. It's not too much. When pleasure feels strong, you don't have to move away from it. Over and over in Betty's sessions, women learn that the urge to take away stimulation when it feels like too much can interrupt pleasure and prevent it from growing into all that it can be in their bodies. Stay on it. Don't stop. Keep it there, Betty tells her clients and us. Meet the intensity with your intensity. Move into it instead of pulling away from it. Ride it. Hang on it. In another memorable scene, Lisa, a client who is exploring her way toward her first orgasm from masturbation, gets to an intense level of arousal at the pulsing edge of orgasm, and her response is to pull the vibrator away from her clitoris. Don't stop, says Betty, guiding the vibrator back to her client's mons. Sorry, Lisa says as she holds the vibrator against her body again. Because of course she apologizes. Stay on it, Betty coaches. Stay on it. Seconds later, we see the unmistakable body-shaking pulses of tension taking Lisa's body like a riptide. With Betty's encouragement, Lisa moans and then screams her pleasure, allowing it to be as big as it wants, to last as long as it wants. In this video, we witness the moment when Lisa learns how to be still with pleasure, not to run from it, and not to try for it, but to allow it, to meet it. How do you feel about your own pleasure? When you're experiencing intense sexual sensations in a safe enough context, do you sometimes turn away from it to diminish it? Let me name the emotion. To worry that a sexual sensation might overwhelm you or be too much is to fear pleasure. Pleasure is not unsafe. You can allow your body to experience all the pleasure you choose to create. As Lama Rod Owens writes in Love and Rage, loving pleasure means that I allow it to be itself. I enjoy it when it arises, and I let it go when it leaves. The most common reason a couple seeks sex therapy is because of problems with sexual desire. So let's imagine a couple who comes to therapy with Peggy Klein Plotz, therapist, sex researcher, and co-author of Magnificent Sex. One partner in this therapy session says, I would be fine if we never had sex again. I'm sorry it makes my partner feel bad, but I just have no interest. Her response? Tell me more about this sex you don't want. Inevitably, the sex they describe is dismal and disappointing. Sex by rote. Sex where the partner doesn't feel attended to. Sex where they don't feel trusting and connected, but rather like they're exposing the bare minimum of their most authentic selves. Or worse, they feel like they have to pretend to be someone they are not. Sex that feels like one partner is a sex vending machine. Peggy replies, well, I rather enjoy sex, but if I was having the sex you described, I wouldn't want it either. Let's pause for a moment to appreciate the jaw-dropping simplicity of this idea. It is normal not to want sex you do not like. If the sex available to you is painful, boring, lonely, or a show you put on for someone else's pleasure, then of course you don't want it. You are not broken. Your sexual desire is not broken. It is normal to not want sex you do not enjoy. And it is normal to not want sex in a context that creates no space for your erotic self. Then Peggy asks the gut punch question. What kind of sex is worth wanting? The answer, broadly speaking, is sex you enjoy. Sex that brings you pleasure. So when people struggle with sexual desire, the question to ask is not, why don't I want sex? It's, how do I create pleasure? But there are other couples who know they'd like it if they could bring themselves to do it, but they just can't. They're stuck. That was me and my spouse. I was stuck. Stuck where, though? What does that mean? And how do you get unstuck? That's what the next two chapters will tell us. Chapter 2, TLDR. 1. Pleasure is the measure of sexual well-being. Not how much you crave it, not how often you do it, or with whom or where, or how many orgasms you have. It's whether or not you like the sex you're having. Pleasure is sensation in context. Context is a combination of external circumstances and internal state. 2. The desire imperative is a cultural narrative that says our experience of spontaneous desire is the single most important measure of our sexual functioning. 3. Spontaneous desire is normal. It emerges in anticipation of pleasure. Responsive desire is also normal. It emerges in response to pleasure. 4. For many low-desire couples, the difficulty is not so much that they don't want the sex available to them, it's that they don't like it. If they don't like it, of course they don't want it. Again, pleasure is the measure. 5. Partners in a sexual connection can treat context as a third thing, a site of mutual curiosity and exploration. Couples who sustain a strong sexual connection co-create a context that makes pleasure easier to access. Some good questions. In what context can my brain most easily experience pleasure? What kind of sexual experiences have I enjoyed in the past? What does the pleasurable experience of sexual desire feel like for me? In what contexts do I experience it? In what contexts do I feel the uncomfortable experience of sexual desire or desire for desire? How do we, as a couple, create a context that makes it easy to access pleasure?